Dinky Dawson, and Tony Rain, and we're kicking off our podcast, Two Pints in a Corner. There you go, Dinky.
Hey, hello, Carter. How are you?
I know that voice. Hello, Dinky. How you feeling, my friend?
Not too bad. I'm up to my neck in it with this surgery, but other than that, I'm now being primed ready for a dialysis, you know, after all these cancers. Now I've got kidney disease. So,
oh, man.
One
thing after another. Well, you're alive and you're still well in spirit, right?
Oh, believe it, I'm doubly well in spirit right now. Unfortunately, yeah. Last thing we did was with Pete Limbo. The next one was going to be with John Boy, but John Boy is not doing so well, and as you know, he's in hospice now and stuff. So.
Yeah, I went to see him at the hospital, and I'm going to... I got errands to do in Boston next Wednesday. I'm going to wait until I get closer, but I'm going to give him a buzz. You know, it's, you never know.
I moved him to a hospice, and I've got a... we'll see what's what.
He's at home now, so...
No, in a hospice.
No, he
is. I thought hospice was visiting
hospice
him.
Is
I
home.
Didn't know that.
Is he in his home?
I think so, yeah.
Oh, no, they gave me an address on there. There was an address that his wife had put up there on Facebook. We'll find out.
I'll have to call because I'd like to see him again. I went in to visit him in the hospital, right? I went to visit him, and he was in... a conference was starting with his doctors, and I said, I can come back. And he said, no, stay here. And they basically gave him the end of life story. He didn't get himself checked out. So, but it's a sad thing, but
but he was the original photographer from the channel.
You know something? I always knew him to be kind of like one of those guys that was always getting backstage like all of us, but I didn't realize that was his official gig, and he told me that.
Yeah.
He's got a lot of cool photos.
Harry let him in early in the 80s. As soon as they started, they let him in to do photography, and he just kept coming and stuff, and he's got a lot of photos and stuff of all you guys and everybody.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's just say this. Welcome to Two Pints in a Corner, and with Tony Rain.
Hey, Carter.
As this Tony, and with me, Dinky.
Hi, Tony. Hi, Dinky.
How you been, Carter? It's been a while.
Yeah, it has been a while. I'm good. I'm good. Okay. I'm healthy. And that's about the best I can hope for. I'm really doing okay.
I think all of us, yeah, that's great. And then we're all still kicking around music somewhere. So
we're doing our best.
Still working.
Yep.
Yeah.
I think you have to.
So here's what we're doing is we're doing a podcast on the channel, and all what's went off there is the major scene in Boston from that time period, even though there was other venues and stuff that I know you went to and... But the channel was home till 2 o'clock in the morning, so you could see the last band every night.
A few years ago, when I started going to shows when I was a kid, I'd collect the ticket stubs. And at some point, I decided to start writing all that information down and keeping a list. And then eventually, when I wrote the book on WBCN, I realized I really need to have that information formalized. So I took a couple of months to put it all into database. And so I actually have a searchable file of all the shows I've ever been to.
Oh.
And I searched by channel shows, and I discovered I was at 191 channel shows and two at the Mad Hatter. So I guess it was like 193 shows at the channel.
Wow. That's the scene. That's the scene.
What was your favorite?
Oh, boy, obviously it's hard, you know. I mean, you remember me, I really loved punk, you know, so seeing the Jam there was amazing.
Oh, right.
You know, seeing James Brown there was pretty awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We've been talking about with various people as they've been coming on is really, and what fascinated me, I was there probably for a total of 4 years on and off, was the diversity of it, you know, and how it would be a different club every night, depending on who was playing. you know, and to the audience, it was just that club. So as we talked to people who were into the punk scene, it was a punk club. Or if, you know, if there were metalheads, it was a metal club. But to us in there all the time, when it changed every day, it was fascinating to watch it go from a hardcore Sunday afternoon all ages show to a roots reggae show on a Sunday night, you know.
It could go from like Grandmaster Flash to the Vibrators, right, to James Brown, to Echo and the Bunnymen.
That's it. I mean, one of my favorites, I was just saying, there was the back in 91, towards the end, we did Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch with Mark Wahlberg on a Saturday afternoon, all ages, and the Damned were loading in at 5 o'clock while the show was still on.
That's great. Well, you know, it's the thing about radio and people try to put listeners into boxes, and so they say, well, if you're a metalhead, then you're not supposed to be into like soul music, and it's not true. I mean, I love everything. Maybe I'm not a good example because I have really wide open tastes, but I think most people don't like just one type of music. So. Yeah, I mean, you could be a regular fan of the channel just to see all these great different sounds. It was awesome.
I think that's what we've been talking about more and more, and that seems to have disappeared from the clubs and the venues. The scene was the club itself, and you'd go and take a chance sometimes and see whatever was there. You know, people were, I think, a little more experimental. Nowadays, you just tend to buy a ticket for the headline show, you know?
Yeah.
And radio back then was more diverse as well.
And in radio and stuff like that, you always got it free. Whereas now, they'll want your money.
Radio is in Boston, certainly. It's actually gone full circle back to where it kind of was when I got involved at the first point. Back in the mid-70s to late-70s was all top 40, and then you had radio stations like WBCN and WCOZ that were starting to, you know, do their mix of album cuts and not ruled by the top 40 charts. And then Boston just went through decades of just this rich radio history with BCN and COZ, and then, of course, FNX and an AAF, and it was just great. And now, all of a sudden, all those stations are gone.
Right.
And if you really want to hear new music, you know, your alternative is probably, you know, WERS, which is Emerson College, but you can hear them everywhere because they have a good signal on different antennas around the region. But yeah, you were challenged to find the new music and go see it.
It was all part of the scene, I think. Yeah, you know, the radio support was key.
Yeah.
It was definitely.
Well, I always said, you know, I mean, a new band, like, would come along. Like, I can't believe how many local bands I saw at the channel. I mean, lots of showcases. But then, you know, when bands got bigger, like, you know, Extreme, and they were starting to break out, or Face to Face, they would headline their own shows there.
Yeah.
Just the fact that you could get, what was the capacity, like, 1,800 or 2,000?
13 something. Legally. Legal was 13.
We won't talk about it.
But, you know, to have a band like Face to Face, you know, selling 1,000 or more tickets to a show, I mean, that was great. And that was just a reflection of how rich the scene was.
And the Stompers and Fools would sell even more.
Yeah. It was really the only room to grow into, you know, outside of the established clubs on the other side that were doing national acts. It was a good to encourage that local scene all the time. And I spent many nights with five bands and nobody in the club, you know?
Yeah.
And the new music nights. Well, you
know, I know one of my favorite memories of the channel was back in May. It was actually May 4th in 1983. And I had the guys from U2 on BCN, and it was, you know, this was the war tour, so they were becoming known. They had sold out two nights at the Orpheum, which were the next two nights, but they were in town a day early. And Edge, you know, after the interview, Edge says, you know, I just played on this album by Jaw Wobble, who was the bass player in Public Image.
Right.
And he's playing the Channel, this place called the Channel.
Yeah.
Do you know where that is? And I go, yeah, I said, I'd love to see that. So I loaded Edge into my truck and we drove down to the Channel. And it was a lightly attended show. But there was, a decent amount of people there. Let's just say there's maybe 200-300 people. So yep. A light show, but... And I'm standing there with Edge, and he's like out in the audience digging the sounds, and it's 83, and so some people know him, but a lot of people don't. Right. And so we'd be standing there, and all of a sudden you'd start to notice people whispering around you, and then we'd move.
Yeah.
And we move over to the right side of the stage, and then nobody knows who he is, and then all of a sudden after about 10, 15 minutes, people start whispering like, is that, and then we'd move over to the other side of the stage.
I like that.
It was just great, going down there with him.
Yeah, well, it was a hang for a lot of people, and it was a good room to see new stuff as well. We've talked about, to us, the diversity was what fascinated me.
I saw John Lee Hooker there.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
In 89. Right. I remember him. I used to spin music. I used to play records in the earlier days and then in the later days.
Right.
And so I used to be there. So I used to end up emceeing for a lot. And right. I did not emcee for the John Lee Hooker show, but I was there. And I was just amazed. There was a chair on stage. I mean, and Dinky, you guys set this up so you would know. All he had was a chair and a mic, and he brought this little suitcase on stage with him and his beat-up guitar.
Yep.
And a suitcase had a harmonica in it and some other stuff. And he just sat out on this chair and just did the boogie, boogie chilling.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And it was astonishing to me because I don't know how old he was at that point, but he would pass away soon after. So he was way up there.
Yeah, I wasn't at the Channel that night, but I did him actually the night after in Chatham on the Cape. In a little theater, the Orpheum Theater. What's now the Orpheum Theater? Yeah, he came down here. We were doing some shows in '88 down here. You're absolutely riveting. Yeah.
Just the fact that he would be touring at that age.
Oh, yeah.
And people say, well, how long are the Rolling Stones going to tour? Well, they're kind of like John Lee Hooker. They're just going to play till they die.
Well,
that's what they do.
We were just talking. 2 weeks ago, I saw Herb Alpert at 88 years old. Up in Nashua.
Yeah,
killer show.
Well, something. I was in London, and when was that? That was last fall. It was around Thanksgiving. I was in London, and Herb Alpert was doing shows at Ronnie Scott's Jazz Club.
That's right. Yeah.
And my wife, and he was doing like 7 nights.
Yeah.
And we, it's a small place, but I thought to myself, hey, it'd be really cool to see him with his jazz band.
Yeah.
Couldn't get a ticket. Couldn't even, it was sold for weeks and weeks and weeks. You couldn't possibly get into that place. That was amazing.
So this was a Monday night in Nashua, New Hampshire. Sold out on a Monday night. 700.
Yeah, that's awesome.
He was phenomenal.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a great show. So, still doing it, which is always encouraging.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's good to see these guys go on.
Yeah, the Channel was always, sometimes we would, we'd have a show at the Orpheum and then hit the Channel afterwards.
Well, that was the beauty. That was the beauty of the 2 o'clock license, right?
Yeah. And it was like, well, who's playing? Well, I don't know. I forget. Let's just go.
Yep.
We go to the show and walk in and there's who knows, John Butcher playing or somebody. It's like, wow, this is great.
Yep.
And there's till 2 o'clock until you get kicked out. some nights when I was emceeing, some nights when you emceed, you got paid by the Channel.
Yep.
Some nights it was a freebie, which is fine.
Right.
So when they ask you to emcee for John Entwistle of The Who, it's like, yeah.
You're just going to do
it's
it.
It's a real privilege. Yeah. But on the nights when I would get paid to emcee, I'd have to go into the business office and I'd be in there till 4 in the morning.
Oh,
trying to get out of there.
Trying to get out,
Sun's coming up, driving over the Tobin Bridge. Oh,
there you go. There you go. I used to say we got paid weekly, very weekly.
Yeah, very, very weekly. there was some, I remember one night, God, what was this? Oh, it was a heavy metal night. It was Wasp and Armored Saint.
Armored Saint. I remember that night.
And that might have been the night that Metallica couldn't get across the Canadian border. I think they were the third band.
They were supposed to be on it, yeah.
And Wasp, these guys, they're big guys, and they came out and they had like cod pieces on and these big like leather boots that came up to their thighs, right? Yeah. But they don't have pants on. They don't have pants. So they've got the cod piece and they got the thigh boots, and it was okay if you were like in the audience, but if you were like backstage or on the side, it was rough.
Yeah. A lot of hairy ass.
And all this.
A lot of hairy ass.
Hanging out. Man.
Oh, yeah.
Getting afraid.
There were some sights to see in there on many different nights.
Many. Oh, yeah. Visuals were amazing. That's right. That's why I used to stand up in the sound booth.
Dinky and I were talking about the butthole surfers in there one night with their video, with their video presentation.
Well, I saw the Replacements there.
Yep.
And for the encore, the guitarist ran on stage butt naked.
Oh yeah.
I guess it's illegal to go on stage naked. I mean, I guess there has to be a cop in the audience, but he had this guitar strategically placed in front of his private, so I guess it was legal. It wasn't necessarily pretty, but it was legal.
Right. Now there were some interesting sights in there.
Oh, very interesting. Butthole Surfers and the girl. Oh my goodness, that was a.
I used to enjoy Wendy O in there in the Plasmatics.
Oh, I like Wendy O. She was great.
I saw the Plasmatics. Did she saw a guitar in half?
She saw a mannequin dressed as Boy George in half.
Oh, they ran out of guitars.
And then one time she saw a Volkswagen Beetle we had to get in there, the shell of a Volkswagen Beetle, and she cut that up.
Well, she did a WBCN commercial, and she blew up a TV, and there was shrapnel everywhere. Crazy.
That's what happens.
You know, Doc.
That reminds me.
Yeah, go to the hospital. How'd you get that? We were blowing up a television.
It sounds like the Move in England back in the 60s.
Yeah.
When the Move used to blow up the TVs and the cars and all kinds of stuff. Yeah. It was, you know, that's before they got the Wizard.
Great stuff.
Yeah, you run out of money pretty quick. But, yeah, there was, some night, we were talking about visuals and seeing too much. There was one night that I emceed. It was a New Year's show. It was Face-to-Face. And they were, their first album was out.
That's right.
And it was on Epic or Columbia. It was a major label. And they were on stage, and I was emceeing. And it was, the big New Year's Eve celebration.
Yep.
And this is way back before cell phones. This is probably, this is 1985, actually.
Yep, and I was there.
And so we were backstage talking with the band, hanging out, having a good old time, until someone, looked at their watch and said, it's, 3 minutes past 12.
forgot the New Year.
Oh, shit. Well, we just so we ran on stage and just hey, it's coming up on midnight, everybody, let's get ready. And nobody knew. And everybody's,
right.
It's like, okay, 10.
There you go.
7. And then I don't know who was in charge. And Dinky, you could tell me. So there was smoke out on stage. And so who does that? Does the band do that, or did you do that?
No, the band does that, and we have to double check to make sure it's legal smoke.
Because at
that time, this is before
the station fire.
I mean, when I came in, there was this false ceiling that we just talked about coming down in the middle of Spinal Tap when they played on there.
Right.
So when I came in 86, I tore everything down because I thought it was dangerous, that stuff, in the false ceiling.
You were right.
Yeah, it was one of those drop ceilings from the restaurant days.
And then you get everybody, it's not just the punk stuff, the metal stuff, and they were doing slam dancing here and slam dancing there and then jumping off the top of the frame of the club and what have you because you're taking it down. But the bottom line is to take that whole stuff down and have it as a big cavernous thing, and it worked out even better because it seemed as though, because of the space above, we could get more people in.
Really?
Not really.
Not really.
Psychologically, there was nothing holding it down. It was just a big cavernous.
So it like a bigger room.
You're making a bigger room. Oh,
so what you're saying basically is that the fire marshal always figures things by square feet, but the channel figured it by cubic feet.
But there you go.
Oh, yeah.
There you go. Because people would stand on each other's shoulders.
Yeah, they used to jump on.
I just remember the night that face-to-face show happened. Whoever was in charge put out so much smoke.
Yeah.
I couldn't even find the microphone.
It would have been Andrew Arsenault.
No.
It was the band.
It was the band. They gassed everybody out because they're only getting an opportunity to do this.
Yeah.
Because other clubs wouldn't let them do that because we'd open the doors in the back and it would all suck out. You know?
And the local bands, it was a big venue for them to play, so they tend to give us their best shows, you know.
Oh, they'd get dressed up like Kiss and all that kind of stuff, and then they were, you know, it was gaudy in some nights.
Yeah.
The band, just leave them alone, let the band play. The next stream would come in and do their number and stuff, and then there'd be fighting between managers and Extreme and this, that and the other and what have you. And then they'd get the girls coming in with coats on and they'd get up on a stage, beautiful, you know, girls here, and then all of a sudden they'd under the coat, there'd be nothing under it but a bra and panties and that kind of stuff. He's trying to sing there, you know. This is the lead singer from Extreme, and he's like well put off because this girls are up there. There was all kinds of stuff that went off that was really creative in a way because it just happened on that one song or this song or whatever. Yeah. And whether it be local band or major band, I mean, you've got all kinds of different things going on. The bands from Australia was interesting. The band from Russia, Autograph, was interesting. You know, there were just so much talent that came through, whether it be local or national everywhere or international.
Yep.
You could get the old style concert if you wanted to. You could get the sit down concerts, you know, when we rented the place to Al Goldman and stuff like that. He'd want to put some seats in there for them to have watch, you know, Chick Corea and that kind of acting there, so the jazz people could sit down and listen to it rather than be in a big mob up front.
The Charlie Watts Orchestra, that always comes to mind.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
Yeah, I emceed the Hell's Angels convention there.
Oh, yeah.
Mario's fundraiser.
Mario.
Oh. That's right. I think I'm still being protected. I don't know.
It was good for me. I was telling a story the other week, Carter, about Mario coming in at 3 p.m. that day, and I was in the club on my own, and I was the bar manager, and he showed up with about 10 cases of Jack Daniels. And said he was bringing his own booze in, and I had to deal with it.
I don't think I've ever been as terrified.
but he respected it. We were fine. We became good friends.
Well, yeah, he was. You would have never known. I mean, there's Hell's Angels reputation, but you would know that he was a decent guy. He was a friend at WBCN. He would show up.
Yeah, he was a good guy.
Come in there when we were on the radio, and like that's Mario from the Hell's Angels is here. It's like let him in.
Say hello.
They were good. That lot was good. They always brought some good fun in there and stuff when they rented it. There were hundreds of bikes out the front and out the side and what have you. You know, the entertainment that they wanted was just straight raw rock and roll.
I think they tortured about 13 local bands into playing that night, I think.
That's right, yeah. Who's going to say no?
Nobody said no. I remember the Bristols being there that night telling me the story.
It's like, you know... I mean, you probably had to say no to Mario about the 10 cases.
Oh, I did. That's why I was terrified.
But you had to say no creatively.
Yeah, absolutely. Creatively.
And I'm sure it wasn't a no. It was kind of a negotiation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. Right.
And then there was nights when the police had their own thing, the Centurion Club, when they stole my car.
Yeah, right.
Oh, man. Really?
Oh, yeah. Well, you have no idea. There was so much went off in there. The best ones was target practice after the club was closed.
Yeah.
Target practice when the rats came up for after the burgers and this, that and the other.
They used to go and buy, get the leftover burgers and stuff, Jack and those guys, and put them on the cocktail tables and then lure the rats out to shoot them.
So they get rid of the vermin that way, but they were shooting rats at 3 o'clock in the morning. Yeah.
Dinky used to try to kill them with the noise in there.
Oh, big time.
Did it work?
No,
they probably
war,
held them back.
Man of War came in and they were doing about 142 dB in the back. And I was saying it's still not as loud as Fleetwood Mac, and nobody would believe me because I played with Blue Cheer and Fleetwood Mac in Detroit. Blue Cheer is supposed to be the loudest band in the world. Peter made me hook up all the amplifiers to give his six-string bass a thing, and I says, you know what we're going to do, don't you? We're going to bring plaster off the walls and this, that, and the other. He says, So that's what we did. We turned it up, and Blue Cheer didn't have a chance afterwards. They were just a small little bitty band with Marshalls, and we had just the whole systems. We had the whole systems and Orange amplifiers cranked up to the max. Until the plaster came down.
That's a good name for a book or a documentary.
Right.
The plaster came down.
Rip the walls
it's amazing
off.
You can hear Dinky. It really is. I don't know how you made it through.
Well, the thing is that the equipment I used and built was a giant hi-fi. It's nothing to do with nothing to do with public address. So I had horns that were the longest in the world, 81 inches long, 41 inches wide, 25 miles with 1 watt. I had 4 of them for vocals that I used to use in big places. And they were, you know, like the Esplanade and stuff like that. I cracked the windows at the Esplanade at the Hancock building and stuff like that, and they were falling out. But that's how it was then. But the acoustic suspension systems is a giant hi-fi. It's all speakers. So it's just a giant hi-fi that was put in the channel with a few little horns just when I wanted just vocals coming out better, you know? And it was a complex system, and I didn't bring the whole thing that I had, which was even better than what was in there. But what was in there kicked some butt there with no messing around, and everybody, the guys like yourself would... It were into the punk and stuff, would suck themselves into the 18s and stuff and go, oh, this is good, I want more of this. You know, and that kind of thing.
The sound at the channel was always great. And you're right. I mean, because it's a big system and it's well-balanced, even though it's really loud, it's not blaring. You can go into a club that's got, like, a really small system and they just crank it all the way and it's screaming with those... You know, those frequencies just assault your ears.
I don't go into them anymore because of that. Because the digital thing has changed everything. We are human. Humans hear analog. We don't hear digital. Period. It's a computer-based system. So when you want to feel good, you've got to listen to a record, an analog record. Yeah. No matter what it is, whatever it is, the dynamics on there will sing away. But the digital will go into a frequency that really hurts your brain. And anyone that's using MP3 in the brain has to, the brain has to change the compression ratio from the MP3 to so you can actually hear the sounds. And that's the problem. And then 10, 20 years later, these people are really deaf. That's why I'm not deaf yet. I don't hear with
pure
earbuds.
Sound.
I hear the pure sound. If I didn't hear that, I'd be deaf as a doornail right now. You know, because of the...
So if we're looking for the perfect Dinky Dawson Christmas gift, it would be a pile of records.
Oh, definitely records. My new record is Lou Reed, 1973. It's going on vinyl. It's Lennox, 2 double album set. And also the one album from London, from the Rainbow. And it's a 3-album set that will be eventually coming out here. We've got I own the copyrights now, so I've got everything sorted. It's really analog. When you feel the rainbow on the, like, you, when it hits Walk on the Wild Side and that bass hits that, you feel the actual Rainbow Theatre. You feel Lennox with people singing behind him. with people singing from the audience. You know, that kind of thing. That's live. That's the real stuff. And you know, in the blues album I did with Fleetwood Mac 1969 in the Shrine, I just recorded what I mixed at the Shrine. It went to number one in the blues charts because it's that good in respect of playing and respect of capturing what they actually played that night. That blues was fantastic, you know?
Well, let's talk marketing. So the Lou Reed at the Rainbow... Is it available in both black vinyl and rainbow vinyl?
Well, that's a good idea.
That's a very good Carter. I like that. Now Tony's
rainbow vinyl.
Tony's got excited.
That'll definitely broaden the audience.
A couple of dollars extra.
Oh, but no, I like that, Carter. Thank you for the idea. Tony,
you can take that. All right.
What are you working on, Carter?
I'm actually, after not writing for about 4 years, because I just did not want to write a book because it does isolate you, I started working on a new project. It's a novel. Can't talk too much about the concept, but uh-huh. I got really excited about it. It was a project that I had worked on, believe it or not, in the 90s and put it away.
Yeah.
And then I was looking through some of my old discs, my computer discs, and I'm like, well, this is a pretty cool. So I started working on it, and I've really gotten into it. So I'm working on I've got the whole setup and of the book and what it's going to be, and I've written two chapters, and now I'm cleaning them up. And I'm going to, instead of writing it all and then self-publishing it or putting out in a small publisher, I'm going to do what I did with the U2 book way back in the old days and get an agent and sell it, try to sell it to a major.
Great. And get an advance.
It works. Right. So yeah, great. That's what I'm working on.
It's good to be busy on that stuff. I'm working on that kind of stuff as well. It's hard, but it's fun.
And the thing about a novel is, you know, I can't get sued because it isn't real.
Right.
I can't say too much about somebody that they don't want me to talk
about.
Exactly.
So. Exactly.
Right. Yeah. No, great. No, and it's creative. I like that. That's great, Carter.
The book that we wrote, Carter, I've just done the whole thing as an audio book. Mick Fleetwood and you have done the forewords and stuff like that and what have you. It's been finally edited right now, but Nancy's actually going through the book because there's so many mistakes in the book originally that was printed. It really is. And then she's trying to keep up with what I'm saying because, you know, I do change things every so often.
You know, that wasn't that LSD trip. It was another LSD trip there. You know, you'd mix them up. Oh, I can't see how that would ever happen.
Right.
So, by the way, I wanted to renegotiate my my percentage on these books. So my lawyers are going to be in touch. Just kidding.
good man.
Good one, Carter. I like that one.
That was a good book. That was a fun book. And Tony, if you can imagine, my agency at the time, because I had come off of writing the YouTube book.
Right.
My agency calls me up and says, there's this guy named Dinky Dawson who has written a book and has given it to us. And he says that he knows you. Do you know Dinky? I go, oh, yeah, I know Dinky. Sure. Blah, 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 blah. He goes, well, he just gave us a 1,000-page book.
Oh, wow.
1,000 pages. And would you be interested maybe in getting involved in getting it down to like 300?
Nice. I didn't know how that worked.
And that's how, I mean, every situation is different, but, you know, most authors don't do all the work first. They just do they put together a concept and they try to sell it. And then if they sell it, then they write it. Well, Dinky had done all the work and he had 1,000 pages of information.
Oh, no.
Which is too much.
Go ahead.
I haven't even got to the Mamas and Papas in the 80s and the 90s. Although channel stuff is what we're working on right now because of the podcasts.
Yeah.
The website's just being updated and we're going to get even more on there. And I think that's the way to go. But, once we've done that, the original book we started, I mean, I've got tons of stuff from Mamas and Papa days, which is the 80s, Rick James, the 80s, you know, stuff that 90s I'm talking of more than anything.
And you can always get another 90s. Book out of the stuff that got weeded out, right, Carter?
Well, I mean, Dinky is, I mean, think about it. It's Dinky has these 1960s adventures when he was a club jock in London, right. And then he's at the Channel in the, you know, the 80s and the 90s, and he's yep. still doing it. So yep. there's
it's all there.
It's hard to write all of that into one book. You
absolutely.
Know? So you,
absolutely.
Several, you know, I think it's going to be kind of like the Britannica. There's going to be like 24 volumes.
Yeah,
yeah. I think you're going to have to do that.
Well, the only thing is that I really would like Nancy to do her book because she's got more from the early 60s all the way through. And that early 60s was amazing stuff that went down in Boston and in L.A. that she was when she was talk about riding around with Dr. Demento on the back of his scooter in L.A.
Well, that's something that most people don't get to experience.
That's right.
Tell you that.
That's right. All right. Well, Cardi,
hey,
we can't...
I have one.
Go ahead.
Can I ask you one question? You would know this, but in the dressing room, there was a dressing room at the Channel that was behind the DJ booth.
Yeah.
Okay, when you went into that dressing room, mm-hmm. there was a hole in the floor that the carpet was over, and you would and
your foot
every
would go
band
in.
That ever was in that dressing room would comment about it, saying, "Are we going to fall into the water?"
Yeah. No, the water didn't come up that far.
No, what was down there was the actual Boston dump from the way back. You could go down there and collect Mason pipes. You could go down there and collect from the stuff from 1800s and stuff down there.
It sounds like you did.
Well, I mean, you know, after chasing a few rats down there, you know. No, but that was exactly what it was. I mean... when they started talking about they were going to knock it down and build, you know, the stuff which they did eventually for the tunnel, that was just, it was all landfill. Such landfill that, I mean, original dump landfill from the way, way back, you know what I mean? And there's this amazing amount of stuff.
I used to joke about the stalagmites hanging from the ceiling from all the hairspray in there.
So if you did go through the carpet, you wouldn't necessarily fall into the Channel.
No.
You just fall into some Revolutionary War stuff.
No, exactly. Although Dinky used to tell me we used to have a thing about the sound and the water on a particularly on a full moon or a high tide Mercury retrograde, the water would come up high enough to get kind of under the stage. And start playing hell with the sound.
That's what you guys would talk about, huh?
Yeah, a lot.
Well, the thing is that we have to every day. You didn't know if the tide had washed and it was shorting out stuff underneath of the original power and stuff that we had.
No, Dinky was always very methodic. Every day we would start from scratch.
Every day. We had to.
I could see you asking the dam to hold their set for an hour until the tide was out.
Yeah, and we got Mark Wahlberg out of there.
No, the dam were always good, though. I mean, everything that I did with them, I enjoyed very much.
I love those guys.
The show.
Yeah.
Just everybody that came through, except Gibby. I couldn't take him anymore with the damn buttholes. I mean, I threw him out the back
after
door.
After the butthole surface was a rough one.
After he set fire to the damn cymbal and blew all the flames all over the place, I said, that's it, you're out. And I got him and his guitar right out them double doors in the back.
That was a big part of the show, though. I didn't realize that. I was just reading an article on a butthole surface in Mojo last month. And that was a big part of the act, was the burning cymbal.
That was his
nightly thing.
That was a nightly thing. He's not going to do that in the Channel anymore. I told you, he went right out the back door.
And the pre-op sex change video, that was the other part.
One of the best nights, though, one of the different nights, talking about the punk stuff and what have you, the guys from Los Angeles, the Survivor.
Oh,
not the Survivors. Oh, what do they call them?
I don't know, man. I'm the band from L.A.
The guys from... anyway, metal band. I'll remember it in a minute. I think you went out and paid them. I paid them, or somebody paid them in the motorhome. They'd just come off stage. They played their metal set. They sat in the their bus and whatever, not motorhome. And what's on the radio or what's on their records was Steely Dan.
They're listening to Steely Dan.
Butthole Surfers.
There's a lot of smoke in the channel, and it's obviously, you know.
It's a distraction.
I said to him, I says, "Oh, you're playing my record. What's the deal?" And he said, "This is good stuff." It is good stuff. Suicidal tendencies. I couldn't believe that's what got me. It's suicidal tendencies that's doing it.
Institutionalized.
But they were good. There was some good. Yeah. There's some good people that I didn't think were going to be good, but they ended up being fantastic. And then there was people who were really, you know, I thought, oh, they're going to be great. They're actually terrible, you know. But that's how it was. It was catch a catch can that night and stuff. Yeah. And especially, you know, the nights when you were bringing people in from where the radio people were coming in. Even Chacha was talking about bringing in Edge into the place Christine coming in and Mick Fleetwood and stuff like that coming in from their shows, you know. And I know you guys were all kinds of people coming in with you and with Tank and with Mark Parento and stuff. You guys would bring all kinds of musicians or meet them there or whatever and big smiles on everybody's face because you were there with the crowd, you know.
Yeah, those BCM promotions were always good.
Oh, fantastic, you know, especially the afternoons.
We had the lunch shows and we had some great concerts. I mean, one of my favorite live broadcasts that BCN ever did was the Georgia Satellites out of there.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Yep.
It was like, if you couldn't see the Rolling Stones, these guys were right there. They were so good then.
Did Sam do that?
Yeah, that's like 1987.
Yep. Did Sam Copper do that, or was it the... the guys from WGBH. I know that
it was probably GBH, but I can't remember for sure.
Yeah.
And we did a great live broadcast with Iggy Pop, which he pressed into a record.
Yeah, that's out in France. I have that live at the channel.
Yeah, that was great. I think that was like sometimes we bring in our Sonics from New York.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, we had a bunch of people. GBH did most of them, though.
Yeah, GBH did just about everything. Sam just did, I think, one or two at the most. But it was mainly GBH that came in because that crew just set everything in the right place and worked for radio and worked no messing and did a good job. It was always sound was great that they did. Because he did, was it Tribe on a New Year's Eve, BCN? Was it Tribe?
I don't know if it was Tribe, but, you know, that earlier we were talking about face-to-face New Year's Eve, and that was a BCM broadcast. That was the night that there was all that smoke on stage, and if you listen to the broadcast, you can hear, at the beginning of it, you can hear me, like, somewhere like 10 feet away from the mic going, hey, everybody. And I'm just walking around trying to find the mic. I mean, that smoke might still be up there. I don't know.
Could be.
And when the smoke went up there, it was definitely, you couldn't see much even with the light on because it would just be cloud you out, you know. That was fun, though.
Yeah. It was fun. That is true. It was a good time. There's a lot more to talk about. Certainly, this podcast can go on forever because there are so many, a million stories in that place, and you guys were there.
We've been working on it for a few weeks. We've got about, I think we've got 15 little shows to launch here. So thanks so much for joining us, Carter. We really appreciate it.
We'll get you again when we come down to some specifics and say, oh, the Carter was here. Carter was there.
Right.
And that kind of thing.
Wow, did Carter actually could remember some stuff.
Yeah. That's good. We've actually been going...
You got to get me while I still can remember this stuff.
That's right. And that's what we're trying to do is just get something documented somewhere, you know.
All right, Tony. All right, thank you.
Thanks, Carter.
Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for taking
time on Two Pints in the Corner.
Two Pints in the Corner, yeah.
And
we'll look for you soon.
Definitely.
All right, my friends.
Thanks,
take
mate.
Care.
Cheers, mate.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.